The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy begins with the total destruction of the planet Earth. It's a comedy. Long before Men in Black, before Galaxy Quest, or even Spaceballs, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy became a science fiction comedy classic, first on radio, then in a best-selling series of books. Tomorrow, The Hitchhiker's Guide arrives at your local Megaplex. The film version stars Martin Freeman as Arthur Dent, the hapless English everyman launched on an interstellar ramble by the aforementioned planetary destruction. Mos Def is his unflappable, often intoxicated alien sidekick, Ford Prefect. And then there's the book that he has with him, a talking book called The Hitchhiker's Guide.
This is the story of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, perhaps the most remarkable, certainly the most successful book ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor. More popular than the Celestial Home Care Omnibus, better selling than 53 More Things to Do in Zero Gravity, and more controversial than Ulan Khaloufid's trilogy of philosophical blockbusters, Where God Went Wrong, Some More of God's Greatest Mistakes, and Who Is This God Person Anyway?
Later in the program, a struggling radio station tries out a 24/7 iPod format. But first, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. If you're a fan, call and tell us why. If you're confused and wonder what any of this could possibly be about or why anyone might think it funny, our number is also the same. It's 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. At the heart of The Hitchhiker's haphazard plot is a search for the ultimate question to life, the universe, and everything. Not the answer, notice. That's the easy part. We know the answer. It's 42. But the question, well, we're putting that in your hands. We've got an email challenge this hour. We want you to send us your best question about life, the universe, and everything with the answer 42. The address is totn@npr.org. And no, you cannot use what is Mariano Rivera's uniform number. I'm taking that one. Joining us now from the BBC studios in Birmingham, England, is Robbie Stamp, executive producer of the film, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much for having me on.
As I understand it, this movie has been in the works almost since the book was published, what, 25 years ago?
Yeah, it's been a very, very long tale, 25 years really. I mean, from the time that the book was published, obviously the radio series came out a few years before that. But as soon as the book was a big hit, then I think that Douglas Adams, the author, knew and wanted there to be a movie. And it's taken 25 years for it finally to happen.
Douglas Adams, of course, died of a heart attack, four or five years ago?
Yeah, it'll be 4 years ago this May the 11th, when he died unexpectedly and so sadly and tragically early of a heart attack in a gym in California.
Hmm. In the movie, he is credited not just with writing much of it, but which is taken from the book, but it's also as a producer. That's a little strange.
I think it was just done really as a mark of respect. I mean, Douglas had worked so hard for so long trying to get this movie made. And when we did the deal with Disney back in 1998, Douglas and I were both executive producers on the movie. Douglas worked, right the way up until his death trying to make the movie happen. And I think everybody involved just felt that it was a mark of respect and completely appropriate that, Douglas should be credited as an executive producer.
In a way, you faced a task similar to the one Peter Jackson had with The Lord of the Rings, adapting a very beloved series of books for film. At the same time, of course, you're trying to please that amazing audience that made them so popular in the first place, but you also need to introduce them to an entirely new audience who doesn't know the first thing of what you're talking about.
You just described my life over the last two or three years. That's absolutely right. I mean, that's the balance. I mean, we know how beloved the radio series, the books, the TV series are of so many people. It does. I mean, making a movie in this day and age with the internet and sort of, this instant reaction you get to what you're doing is so different from bringing something like this to life sort of 15 years ago. And you're right. I mean, we did face very similar challenges to the Lord of the Rings team, whereby you've got to do something which brings the vast majority of your existing fans and people who love it with you, but also find a way of reaching out to a new audience. And Douglas absolutely wanted us to do both. and it's something that I very much hope we manage to pull off. And certainly the early signs are very good. I mean, the screenings that we've been having, it does seem as if, you know, the majority of the fans are going, yeah, it's a worthy addition to the canon. And I think that's all we want, really, is we're so deeply respectful of what's gone before. We just want the movie version to come and take its place amongst this, you know, astonishing and unique body of work. And I hope that's what it does.
We're talking today about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 25 years after the books first appeared. That, of course, came after the radio series. The movie version hits, a theater near you tomorrow. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's start with Leslie. Leslie's calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi there.
Hi.
I absolutely love the radio play and read the books as well, so I'm really excited to hear about the movie coming out.
And when did you first encounter Hitchhiker's Guide? Was it the radio?
It was the radio. I was in the Peace Corps down in Fiji in the South Pacific, and just before going into the Peace Corps, had gotten married and received a radio as a wedding gift so that we wouldn't lose all touch with the outside world while we were stationed in the sort of Netherlands. And during the midday, it would broadcast out of Australia. And the first time I heard it, I was preparing lunch with a number of, say, 4 or 5-year-old Fijian children around me and who didn't speak English. And I am laughing so hard, I'm crying. And these kids are looking at me like I just lost my mind. And I religiously listened to it every series. It was absolutely amazing.
Robbie Stamp, you must have heard 1,000 stories like that.
Well, yeah, but it's always wonderful to hear them. And I mean, it always, you know, as I say, it's just one of those things that it just seems to have made an indelible impression on so many people. And it's just got this unique blend of humor and intelligence and invention. And it's just such a great formula. I mean, it's so rich with ideas. It's so rich with jokes. And Douglas was one of the most genuinely, primarily creative people, you know, I've certainly ever been lucky enough to meet. But, you know, he was in that very, very thin layer of truly original creative people. And I love hearing stories like that. And yes, I've heard many, but, you know, I can never hear enough of them.
Oh, it's wonderful. I have the whole tape series, cassette series of the radio. I made it for my son when he, you know, was old enough to listen to it. He's 22 now, and he's familiar with it as well, so it's pretty.
Well, I think it's one of the things that we're certainly finding is that it is, you know, in the classic sort of movie terms, people always ask, forgive my ghastly American accent, but, you know, what's your demographic? You know, who's this movie aimed at? And, you know, the answer is it seems to have this capacity to appeal to, you know, a bright, curious 8-year-old. And then, you know, we've got people who've been fans for 25 years who are in their 60s and 70s coming and loving it. And it's just this unique thing which has just got this capacity to appeal across the generations and for everybody to find something in it. And I hope that what we've been able to do is to work with the way that Douglas wanted to reinvent the story for the movie. And that's a very important point to make, that Douglas was always up for reinventing Hitchhikers. The radio is different from the TV, which is different from the books. And there's a lot of new material in the movie, as well as a lot which people will be very familiar with. But all of the crucial new material in the movie is brand new Douglas Adams ideas that he wrote specially for the movie.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I hope you enjoy it.
Thanks, Leslie.
I will.
Bye-bye. Let's get one more caller in. Vincent. Vincent's with us from Long Island in New York.
Hi.
Hi.
I've read all 5 of the books, actually, ever since I was in middle school, and I found them all incredibly hilarious. I even had a chance to, just by mistake, catch the 1981 live action of The Hitchhiker's Guide. I thought that was hilarious, too, even considering.
You mean the TV show?
Yes. I don't even know what it was. I just.
It was, yeah. It would have been the TV show.
Yes, and even with a small budget that they had, it was hilarious. My question is, the trailers that I've seen on TV and even reviews I've read online, it shows that a bit has been taken out from the actual stories, just a few things here and there. I wanted to know, was that intended or just because you only had so much time to work with the movie and whose decision was that exactly?
Well, I mean, the key thing about it, as I was just saying, sort of really at the end of Leslie's call, is that Douglas himself knew that you can't just do the radio with pictures or the book with pictures, or indeed the TV series, which had, you know, several half-hour episodes in which to tell the story. And so what we had was the blueprint, which was Douglas Adams' last screenplay, which was not only a clue for what the new material that he'd written to put in. So, for example, this scene on the planet Vogsphere where these literally slapsticks rise out of the ground and smack you in the face if you're having an original idea, which was there to breed the capacity for original thought out of the Vogons. And that's a brand new Douglas Adams idea. Through to we knew what he wanted to put in, but we also clearly had a very good sense of what he was willing to leave out. And in fact, we've put back in some key Hitchhiker moments, like the whale falling to Earth, for example, having been, you know, one moment the whale is a missile, and the next minute it's turned into a sperm whale and falls to Earth. That wasn't in Douglas's last script, but is pure Hitchhiker moment, and that's gone back in. So I think that the answer is, in terms of what to leave out, and I'm not sure which the review you're referring to is, but I have a suspicion which one it might be that you're referring to, and it really is the only review, frankly, out there on the internet like that. It's one that is a 10,000 word critique of what we've left out. And what we've left out was, you know, what Douglas was willing to leave out. And our job, really, when we came to it after Douglas died, was not to invent any new material, because Douglas had invented it all, was just to try and cram as much in there from the world and the universe as we could. But you've got a movie. It's a much shorter time. It's got the rhythm and pacing that a movie has, and it's just different from books and radio. And when I said at the beginning of the show that I genuinely just wanted to sort of take its place amongst the canon of work as a movie version, which isn't going to replace the radio or replace the books or replace the TV. It just is the movie version.
This sounds like the voice of a man who's answered an awful lot of email over the past few months at this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been traveling around the world doing questions. And I understand, you know, I'm a fan, and I understand how much people care about this. But as I say, I'm not sure. You know, it sounds like somebody who's read all five books would probably have found this particular review that, you know, I'm aware that's out there as well. But there are plenty of other fan reviews out there who absolutely have loved what they've seen. They've come out with tears in their eyes. And I think the vast majority of fans are going to be delighted.
Vincent, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. We want to hear from you. 800-989-8255. Email totn@npr.org. And remember our email challenge. What question with the answer 42 explains the life, the universe, and everything? Email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and Amanda Oakes of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, has responded to our email challenge. Question, how many times will coworkers pull me away from my desk on some task while I'm trying to catch this NPR program on The Hitchhiker's Guide? As we all know, the answer is 42. We're talking, of course, about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. If you're new to Douglas Adams' bizarre books, here's the basic idea. A Vogon constructor fleet demolishes the Earth to make way for an interstellar bypass. The only survivors of this cataclysm are Arthur Dent, a nebbishy Brit, and his friend Ford Prefect, an alien. Together, they team up with the ultra-flaky president of the universe, his human girlfriend, and a depressed android to embark on a series of comic adventures in search of the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. But trying to describe The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by plot alone is a little like trying to convey Mahler's Ninth Symphony with a kazoo. The real geniuses are in the flourishes. A reincarnated bowl of petunias, poetically inclined Vogons, pan-galactic gargle blasters, and a thousand other insane creations of its author, Douglas Adams. As we've mentioned, Adams passed away in 2001. In a 1982 interview with NPR, he explained the thought process behind his many incredible ideas. His words were helpfully illustrated with clips from the original BBC series of radio dramas.
This is something I like to sort of call judo thinking. You get to the first scene of your plan, and you don't actually manage to make it funny, so you have to turn it on its head in some way, which means then your plan goes out of the window and you have to do something else following on from what you've done. But at one point, fairly early on, Ford Prefect and Arthur Dent get hurled gratuitously out of the ship. So I thought, they've got to be rescued somehow or other. And I was instantly up against the problem of, you know, it was going to be extremely improbable.
So this is it! We're going to die!
Yes. Except... no. Wait a minute. What's this switch?
What? Where?
No, I was only fooling. We are going to die after all.
You know, it's at times like this when I'm trapped in a Vogon airlock with a man from Beetlejuice and about to die of asphyxiation in deep space that I really wish I'd listened to what my mother told me when I was young.
Why? What did she tell you?
I don't know. I didn't listen.
So I thought, all right, let's turn it on its head. Actually, let's use the problem against itself and invented the idea of the improbability drive, which is why they get picked up, and then develop it from there.
2 to the power of 20,000 to 1 against and falling.
Arthur, this is fantastic. We've been picked up by a ship with the new infinite improbability drive. I mean, this is really incredible, Arthur. Arthur, what's happening?
Ford, there's an infinite number of monkeys outside who want to talk to us about this script for Hamlet they've worked out.
That from the BBC radio series The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Its latest incarnation, a feature film, opens in theaters tomorrow. You can watch clips from the new movie and read the first chapter of the book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, at our website, www.npr.org. And, of course, now you're invited to join our conversation about the book. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Robbie Stamp, executive producer of the film, and joining us now is Peter Gazzardi, American editor of several of Douglas Adams' books. And Peter Gazzardi joins us from the studios of member station WUNC in Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
And I wanted to ask you, the book has remained a cult classic on both sides of the Atlantic. It's still in print. Has it always been in print for the last 25 years?
Oh, absolutely. He's written, there must be 10, 12 books that are all still in print. The only one that's not at the moment are the radio scripts. And given the popularity of the movie coming up, they'll probably come back in print pretty quickly as well.
Mm-hmm. Humor often dates pretty quickly. What keeps these books so funny after all this time, do you think?
Well, it's social satire, finally. And Douglas is an amazing social satirist. So, yes, there's slapstick. Yes, there's science fiction. But what makes it endure is the way Douglas can stand outside of all of our lives, the culture we live in, and poke fun at it in a way that makes us laugh out loud.
Here's an email we got from Lawrence Lee in Two Harbors, Minnesota. I love these books, and they were an integral part of my college life. They challenged human arrogance, just like a college student should. Now, with great trepidation, I'm reading them to my children. My absolute favorite sentence in the English language was in the first book, "The ships hung in the sky in much the same way that bricks didn't."
It's funny you should say that. And hi, Peter. How are you?
Good. How are you, Robbie?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you. Very well indeed. Nice to meet on air again. When my daughter was reading the book, that was exactly the line that she brought me, and she read it out loud to me, and exactly that kind of mind-expanding moment of reading something which just flips your brain inside out. And she couldn't get over, and she was 10, and she just couldn't get over what a fabulous line that was. And that was very much her favorite line as well.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. Bill is with us from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Thank you very much for taking my call. A great fan of the books. I mean, not only, as you just mentioned, a great social satire, but I also looked at as a political satire that appears to endure. Was that possibly one of Mr. Adams' intention? I mean, Zaphi Beeblebrox, I think you could all see a little bit of Bill Clinton and him, and he and Bill Clinton as the ultimate politician that distracts us.
Peter,
I'll take comments off the air.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Peter Gazzardi, do you want to try that?
I mean, Douglas was, I mean, I think in some interesting way, Douglas, I edited a book that we published posthumously called The Salmon of Doubt. And in this book is the novel that Douglas was working on when he died, and a kind of amazing collection of various bits and pieces that Douglas wrote throughout his life, starting when he was 12 years old and sent a letter into the local newspaper. And you can see from this book that Douglas was always kind of standing, saw himself or felt himself to be kind of standing apart from the world. This guy was 6'5" when he was in elementary school? I mean, when he was like 13 or 14, 6'5" tall, with a nose that he writes a 10-page essay about, which is quite prominent, one might say. So he's the kind of quintessential outsider looking at all of us, at all of humanity and our foibles and what we take so seriously, and poking fun at it, whether it's politics or our social lives or or anything that we might take seriously, most especially ourselves.
Robbie Stamp, somebody who's seen the movie, might find a distinctly Clintonian aspect of Zaphod Beeblebrox.
Well, yeah, I think in Sam Rockwell's performance, who's the actor who's playing Zaphod, I know that there are definitely sort of, there's more than a shade of Clinton, and there's a bit of George W. in there as well, I think, if you were to ask Sam on some of the influences for his performance. And just quickly to pick up the point about Douglas's nose, Douglas's nose features very prominently in the movie itself. We have a sequence on a planet which believes, or the people of the inhabitants of this planet believe, that we were all sneezed into existence by the Great Green Arkle Seizure. And everybody lives in fear of the coming of the Great White Handkerchief. And we thought, well, if you're creating a you know, you've got a religion which believes this, then what would be the religious symbolism? What would be the iconography? And we thought, well, it'd be noses. And we thought, well, the nose we'll use, we had a 3D sculpt of Douglas Adams' nose from a computer game that he and I did together some years back. So there, for example, the entrance to the temple of this religious cult, it's a 30-foot-high sculpt. We actually built a 30-foot-high, 10-meter-high sculpt of Douglas Adams' nose. The door handles in the temple are based on Douglas Adams' nose. So, yeah, Douglas's nose, in honor of Douglas's nose, we built an entire religion around it.
We've got a couple of more responses to our email challenge from Alexander Matheson in Lyndhurst, Ohio. As my wife's 42nd birthday approached, it was made clear to our children, who were devotees of the story, that she would be known for the following year as the answer to life, the universe, and everything. Well, it still applies some 20 years later. We first listened to The Hitchhiker's Guide on the Hong Kong radio link of the BBC World Service, and it had a pivotal influence in our lives. Another email response from Nicole Greenwood. How many licks does it take to get to the Tootsie Roll center of a Tootsie Pop? 42, of course. Let's get another caller on the line. Ian. Ian's with us from Franklin Lakes, New Jersey.
Hi. I'm just curious to ask the person in charge of the movie whether or not Marvin's voice is the same as the BBC radio production.
No, it's not. We played with that idea for a very long time, and of course we were able to put the voice of the original Stephen Moore over the performance that Warwick Davis, who's the actor who's inside the Marvin suit, and in the end we've gone for Alan Rickman. And I think the reason for that is that a sort of a contemporary actor who does intelligent and depressed brilliantly is Alan. And I think we felt that as all the other voices in the film were new, we didn't want sort of one major throwback. But it was a decision that was taken relatively late, and we did think about it very, very hard.
Ian, to give you a chance to get a preview, here's a clip from the movie early in the plot. Marvin arrives to bring interstellar hitchhikers Ford and Arthur up to the bridge of the ship that they've just landed on.
I've been ordered to take you up to the bridge. Oh, please yourself. Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they ask me to take you up to the bridge. Call that job satisfaction, because I don't. You can thank the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation for building robots with GPP.
What's GPP?
Genuine people, personalities. I'm a personality prototype. You can tell, can't you?
Any early reviews, Ian?
Very good. Very apt to the character. And, just to add, my favorite quote from the radio series would be when Ford is talking to Arthur in regards to the ship they just stole from Millie Waves, and he says, "I saw one in flight once. It was magnificent. Looked like a fish, moved like a fish, and steered like a cow."
Okay.
We'll try and get that in the sequel.
Is there going to be a sequel?
Well, no. I'm not letting anything out of the bag there. If you know, as Peter knows only too well, I mean, there are four more books. If everybody, you know, loves this movie as much as it's beginning to look as if they're going to, then let's hope that there are sequels. It's a big galaxy out there.
More email. My whole family were fans of the BBC series, writes Jessica. And when I was growing up in Maryland, to the extent that we renamed our sailboat Heart of Gold, Zaphod's spaceship's name. Just the other day, I was walking down by the harbor in my current home of Port Jefferson, New York, and spotted another sailboat with the same name. I didn't realize there were other geeky sailors out there like myself. And let's get another caller on the line. Nate. Nate's with us from Kalamazoo.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
I just wanted to mention, I just graduated from college with a degree in philosophy, and oftentimes we have to talk about our favorite philosophers, and of course, you know, Berkeley and Hofstadter come up often, and I always brought up Douglas Adams, because when I was a young man and I was reading The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there's some very, very powerful, thinly veiled philosophical references in there that I'm not sure. I'm sure a lot of readers pick up on them. But the one that is most prominent in my mind is the story of the man who rules the universe, and I won't give anything away. But
well, Peter Gazzardi, is this the detritus of a very good education washing up in these stories?
Yes, it is. I mean, and I think that, you know, there's a philosophy underlying all this. One of the things Douglas often talked about was his favorite book, The Blind Watchmaker, a Richard Dawkins book. The subtitle of that book being Why the Evidence of Evolution Reveals a Universe Without Design. And Douglas was very big on this notion that all of us kind of believe this universe must have been created for our enjoyment, because how else could it have happened? And he often told the story of a puddle. And he says, here you are, you're a puddle, right? And you look at this little, the shape of the space that you're filling, and you think, well, this must have been created for me. I mean, the universe is clearly created to give this puddle this shape. And that we go through life kind of much the same way. So there was a kind of underlying philosophy underneath all of Douglas's work, I think. And I think that's a very astute comment.
Nate,
can I chip in quickly on that one as well?
Yeah.
Just to say, just very quickly, I mean, the whole philosophical idea, one of my favorite scenes in the movie, I've alluded it to briefly already, is this sperm whale that is 1 minute a nuclear missile and is next minute changed into a sperm whale. And as it falls to Earth, it literally has an ontological discussion. It discusses its purpose in life and how it can exist without the capacity to name itself and its environment. And then it falls to Earth with a great big thud. And in that one sequence, you've got everything that sums up what made Douglas a genius. You've got the wild invention of turning a missile into a whale. You've got genuine ideas and thought, and you've got a great joke which rounds the whole thing off. And I'm delighted to say that the whale features prominently in the movie. From the screenings we've had, it's absolutely one of people's favourite scenes, and it's pure Hitchhikers, because it's got no plot relevance, it's got no character relevance. It's just the kind of thing that makes Hitchhikers unique, and it's firmly in the movie.
We're talking about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Of course, the movie opens tomorrow. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Despite the outlandish ideas in his books, Douglas Adams was tremendously fascinated with the realities of science. And joining us now is Dr. Jack Cohen, a reproductive biologist by training who has written extensively about the possibilities of extraterrestrial life. Adams met Cohen at a conference many years ago, and Dr. Cohen joins us now from his home in Newent, England, to tell us about that encounter. Nice to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a remarkable encounter, actually, because it was very typical of Douglas's life, and to some extent of mine. I'd just given a talk. This was in Brighton on the south coast of England. It's a seaside resort, and we were having the World Science Fiction Convention, something above 5,000 folks from all over the world, a lot of Americans. And I had given a talk on the possibility of life on other planets to all my favorite authors, really, and lots of people that took me up on lots of the themes, and it was great. Now, in those days, people smoked in lecture theaters, and at the end of the time, there must have been 300 people in a lecture theater set up for 200, and I was just collecting my slides out of the carousel, and this enormously tall guy came in and obviously took me for the man who was doing the AV. He said, when you've done that, would you put my slides in? I can never do it right. Typical of Douglas, actually. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, sure. He said, what was happening here before? And I said, oh, the possibility of life on other planets. Oh, he said, yes, that chap, Jack Cohen. So I strung him along for about a quarter of an hour before he realized that I was the said Jack Cohen. And I've seen him do that with other people as well, pretend to be other than he is. Anyway, when he finally tumbled to who I was, we went off for a beer, and he told me this the really exciting thing that had just happened to him. Now, at the end of Hitchhiker, you are asked the question, what is 6 times 9? And given the answer, 42. It shames me to say that very many people read that and just accept it as the answer. But, of course, 6 times 9 is not 42. And
Not in base 10, it isn't.
Not in base 10, precisely. Now, he had just discovered, not 20 minutes before, that in base 13, it actually is. And he was so delighted that it should be base 13, which is, you know, if it had base 17 or base 6 or something, it wouldn't have kind of mattered. But base 13 has all that to magic.
Ah.
And he was just so delighted.
Are you looking forward to the movie?
I'm looking forward very much to the movie, except, and you know what the except is, don't you? You feel it yourself. All of us who read a book and see the movie know this feeling. The movie is so much smaller than the book. Once you've seen the movie, your imagination is, particularly if it's very well animated and so on.
As my colleague Susan Stamberg would say, the pictures are better on the radio. Jack Cohen, thanks very much for being with us. We'll have more on The Hitchhiker's Guide after the break. This is NPR News. Of course, now we're getting some email to our email challenge. How many presidents were there before George W. Bush, writes a JFR in Washington? Of course, the answer is 42. Robert Richardson from St. Louis, Missouri. The ultimate question, what is the perfect temperature to serve a pint of Guinness Stout? And finally, from Matthew Schumann in La Crosse, Wisconsin, the amount it's going to cost to take me and my wife and son to see this movie this opening weekend, $7.50 times 3 admission, $2.50 times 2 large sodas, 2.25 times 1 for a small soda, $4.50 times 1 for large popcorn, $2.50 times 3 candy for each, and a quarter plopped in the tip jar. The total is 42. The movie version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy does open this weekend. Its executive producer, Robbie Stamp, is with us from the studios of BBC in Birmingham, England. And also with us is Peter Guzzardi, who was the editor, the American editor for many of Douglas Adams' books. And he's with us from the studios of member station WUNC in Raleigh, North Carolina. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Dimitri. Dimitri is with us from Silicon Valley in California.
Hi. First of all, a comment, and then I have a question as well. The comment is, I've been using Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and quotes from it as a litmus test for cultural geekhood for years now. To include, in fact, an interview question, complete the following sentence, group, I implore thee. Now, given that, I'm also curious, was the fifth book intended to preclude any chance of a sixth book by destroying every possible Earth in every possible universe?
Peter Guzzardi.
I would say definitely not. And in fact, as long as Douglas, right till the moment he died, really, Douglas was unsure whether the Salmon of Doubt, his novel in progress, was going to be the sixth Hitchhiker or whether it was going to be a Dirk Gently. That was still going back and forth in his mind.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dimitri. Let's go to another phone call, and this is Jennifer. Jennifer's with us from Salem, Oregon.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Hi.
I've got a few comments here, and this is the result of years of pent-up geekiness, because nobody else I know actually likes this book as much as I do. Well, series, actually. So Alan Rickman as Marvin, yay. Zaphod Beeblebrox is somewhat hot, double yay. It's definitely been nice to see an acknowledgement of free thinkers. I've been a fan since I was in the eighth grade. I was smart enough not to admit this to just anybody. And like the previous caller, I've been kind of using it as a measure, not so much as cultural geekiness, but a measure of whether somebody was cool enough to be friends with me. It's sort of the fish in the sand that the early Christians used to draw.
Hmm.
I'd tell people, you throw in a few references, and if they understood why the answer to life was 42, then they were worth my time. And I used it as a way to survive through junior high school, because I was just really glad to know that out there in the universe were aliens who were 9 times hipper than the people who were making my life miserable at the time. And if all else fails, I at least learned not to panic.
Jennifer, I will say that, of course, you're not alone. We put the name Zaphod Beeblebrox onto a phone search engine called Switchboard, and we found a Zaphod Beeblebrox listed in Charlottesville, Virginia, in Blacksburg, Virginia, in Atlantic City, Nevada, and also in Whitethorn, California. So there are good-looking guys with two heads and a spaceship out there.
That's great. Well, the problem is that they're always looking for the triple-breasted you-know-what for the FCC. and unfortunately, I don't fit the bill.
I wonder, Robbie Stamp, when you're making the movie, Zaphod, as everybody knows, has two heads, and we all remember the prosthetic device that rode on the shoulder of the actor in the TV show. Was that a challenge to make it look something different?
Yeah, it was a huge challenge. I mean, it was something that Douglas and the director who was originally attached before the current director Garth Jennings came on board, Jay Roach, were working on a lot because, you know, anatomically we're not very suited to having two heads on our shoulders. And for Douglas originally when he wrote it, it was just, you know, it was a throwaway line. You know, you're writing a radio series and you can give a president two heads with the, you know, a couple of flashes of a couple of strokes on a typewriter. But I think that it has been a technical challenge. We've solved it a particular way. It seems to be working. People seem to be enjoying it. It means he doesn't have two heads the whole time. He has a head that sort of, you know, lives somewhere else tucked in under his neck, and it comes out every now and then. And the key thing really that Douglas was working on was to try and give the two heads a distinctive character. I think he felt that, you know, there were dramatic possibilities that he hadn't explored fully enough in the radio or the books, and to try and, you know, have the two heads represent two slightly different sides of Zaphod Beeblebrox, and that's something we've very much continued, and Sam's performance very, very much does that.
Jennifer, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can get one more caller in. Ted. Ted's with us from Park City, Utah.
Hi, Neil. Yes, I thought the... I had the pleasure of being at a screening of the movie on Tuesday night, a media screening, and I just thought it was sensational. I thought it was fantastic. And a really nice mix of sort of low-tech and high-tech special effects. And also, I just liked the fact that there was no violence in it. There was no meanness. There was no good versus evil, the sort of thing you even get in, you know, Harry Potter movies. It was just a really great movie for the whole family and did great justice to the book, I thought.
Robbie's going to really object to that.
Absolutely. I cut this man off. Get him off the air. No, I mean, I tell you, one of the things I'm really pleased about is you picking up on that low-tech aspect. We very much felt, and this was something that Garth Jennings, this brilliant young first-time English director that we chose to make the movie, felt, is that Hitchhikers just would have... I don't know, it would have drowned under the full-bore CGI treatment that so many sort of big epics get. And that, so we've gone for these fabulous creatures, which are real, you know, fantastic feats of engineering. But it meant that, you know, our actors didn't spend weeks on end acting opposite a tennis ball on a stick. And you can feel that. You can just feel it's giving it an edge and an anarchy and a playfulness and a joy, which just matches the material. So I'm delighted to hear you say that, and I'm glad you enjoyed it as much as you did. And please tell everybody to go and see it this weekend.
And next time, Ted, he wants you to pay for it, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Enough of all these screenings. The screenings stop here.
With regard to the special effects, I mean, I said to a friend of mine, there are some spectacular special effects, but more often than not, it seemed like instead of going for spectacular, you went for interesting.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You're right. I mean, there is a wonderful moment where we arrive at the planet that is capable of building planets, Magrathir,
right.
And, you know, envisaging that space is, you know, you need everything that state-of-the-art CGI can do for you now. But we just wanted interesting. And there's, you know, there's a film trick in there which is as old as filmmaking itself. It's I mean, I'm going to spoil the surprise, see if people can spot it. But Garth used everything available to him as a filmmaker. CGI where CGI is appropriate, fantastic. Puppets where they're appropriate, and some really old in-camera tricks, the stuff that just has happened right in front of the camera with a single frame splice. And it's just funny. It's just great.
Ted, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, and thanks for the great work.
Thank you very much.
And I'd like to thank both of our guests today, Robbie Stamp, executive producer of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Good luck with the movie.
Thank you very much. And listen, thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. And Peter Gazzardi, thanks for your time today as well.
Thank you, Neil.
Peter Gazzardi was a Douglas Adams American editor and joined us from the studios of WUNC in Raleigh, North Carolina. A couple of last emails from Celeste Connolly in Queen Creek, Arizona. As a molecular biology student at the University of Wyoming, struggling through physics, I finished the final exam with the closing, "So long and thanks for all the fish," something I think I'll say when I'm a crazy little old lady in 50 years. And finally, one last answer to our email challenge. The question, of course, the answer, of course, is 42. The question to life, the universe, and everything. This from Nathan Whitney of West Jordan, Utah. If the most influential person in the galaxy were to drop in, should you invite them to lunch only or for tea too?